Welcome to the Friday Workplace Briefing. Workplace law changes so quickly. Tune in weekly to find out how the law is changing and what you need to do.
G'day, how are you?
Good, thanks, Andrew. You seem jittery.
You notice I'm dreaming. Well, I've had so much coffee today.
I'm up to three,
and I've had some peach tea. Homemade peach tea.
Oh, peach tea.
Yeah,
okay.
That had a fair bit of caffeine in it too, so I'm a bit off. Interesting stuff. Before we get on the cases, I was just reading before we came on air about a prison guard who headbutted a glass divider between himself and the prisoner, got sacked. Said some words which were probably better left unsaid, but the prisoner was doing chaotic and crazy stuff. And there was a deputy president who said, I don't think it's reasonable to expect angelic behaviour from a prison guard. And it comes back to something that you and I are dealing with every day, and that is people have got to be safe to fail every now and again. People will say and do some
dumb stuff,
but they can't be measured against unrealistic measure of what is good.
Yeah, it's got to be reasonable, otherwise it's always going to fall apart.
Yeah, and the other part is, I think you said it because we were talking about prisons. You said the crime has to be the punishment. And it's true that we've become a bit precious. I guess that's what I'm saying.
But I think, yes, a bit precious, but also I think people try to set these rules that people are going to fail, basically. And you're setting yourself up for failure by enforcing these rules, because then you'll inevitably have someone you like who is normally a great employee who then fails and you set this.
Imagine if we banned swearing. We'd sack him.
I think we'd also be fired.
But I guess that's my point, you know, that the tribunal, the Fair Work Commission, is a robust tribunal. It's used to dealing with true work situations.
And they're really practical as
well.
Yeah,
so have a think about it. Anyway, I read this case and I was giggling because I was giggling with some of the conversations in the last 2 or 3 weeks I've had. People will make mistakes.
Yeah, we'll probably have a more in-depth discussion about it next week.
I think that's time for me to move on, is it? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and well, so the workers.
So I won't be talking about your wedding. I promise not to. So let's go on to the first case.
Hey, you want to talk about the workers' comp?
Oh, yeah, I do. That's, by the way, we're filled. So our masterclass on workers' compensation that we had, I think, on May 1 is now full. Mm-hmm. But please, if you want to come, send in, and we're
to our admin email address.
Yeah, to our admin email address, and we're putting another one on for the people already who've missed out on that one. I'm sorry for those who've missed out, but we are putting on another one, and we'd love to have you along, and that'll probably be in a month or two after then.
Yeah.
And not only that, at that stage, we will have seen the new legislation land and have more commentary about it. So
you probably can do, like, case studies then.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, so now let's look at alternative employment cases. A number of people think this is a really cunning idea. That is, when they arrange alternative employment for somebody when business is restructuring, whatever, they rub their hands together and go, let's go to the Fair Work Commission and reduce the redundancy payment on the basis that we've provided acceptable employment. Can I tell you, it's an incredibly expensive process and time-consuming process to go to the Fair Work Commission. So when you're being very cunning over $2,000, perhaps don't. And this is a case of perhaps don't.
Yeah, this one was so
silly. This was a part of a business that was closed down and sold off.
Yeah.
And
they'd outsourced this group of employees.
Yeah. So out go these employees. They're employed by
another electrical business.
Same work, but they don't have a car allowance as part of it, and there's a significant amount of travel to and from work.
Yeah, it's about 80 kilometres, and previously they had their own car, and under the new arrangement, no car, no car allowance.
So there you go. And someone must have advised them, and probably they've gone into deep cover now and hiding, that it would be a good idea to seek to reduce the 13 weeks redundancy payment was due because it is like or similar acceptable employment. It could never be acceptable employment when a major term of benefit is removed from what it's got. So, look, we put this case up, to quote my father, not to be too smart by half. This was a decision that was, yeah, they should have been patted on the back for ensuring they found alternative employment, but don't try and reduce redundancies, because your obligation is you can't do it without going to the Fair Work Commission.
Yeah, which is a good reminder, because sometimes people just think they've offered the employment and that's sufficient and then they don't have to pay it, which you can't do as well.
Yeah.
But I think, Andrew, in this case, it would have been probably different if, say, there wasn't such a long commute and it was just an additional benefit.
Yeah.
I think then offering another with the same pay wouldn't have been weighed the same.
Yeah, still struggle though, because it's not the same REM you're not getting the same benefit out of your wage package. And when you're getting the same benefit, you're not getting the same benefit, and that's the end.
But you could offer it as an allowance instead of a car.
Yeah, you could. Yeah. If they offered it as an allowance, they'd be absolutely fine. Qantas, well, there's a whole lot of Qantas news at the moment, including the ground staff who look like they're getting millions and millions of dollars of compensation.
The union really pushed this.
Very funny, because you see the, I won't mention the plaintiff law firm, but they congratulate themselves all the way through in the news, only then to be smacked by the court for being dilatory and slow in what they were doing. But that's just part of my pleasure, really. But this is a subsidiary of Qantas, whose enterprise agreement expired in 2020, and they're still bargaining. And there's five different unions that sit on the back end of this, all of whom now are not making any submission in relation to contractual bargaining.
Yeah, it's so weird. They're just like, yep. Okay.
Yeah, I think they're not all opposing. I think they're all tired. And the truth is, after 4 years of not getting a pay rise, I think it's time to stop, don't you?
But also, with the new changes, so the original offer was a 25% increase.
Yep.
And it was voted down twice. So it makes sense for it to be an intractable bargaining decision. But I guess with the new changes through closing the loop, why would the union object? They're not going to have worse.
They're not
terms.
Going to be worse off.
Yeah.
So that's just a great point, Nani, because under the old intractable bargaining-like clauses that existed, if you got to the court to determine it, you could end up with less than what you've already got.
Yeah.
Whereas under the closing loop,
under
the intractable bargaining rules, you can't end up with less than what you've got. You've 4 years without a pay rise. The union's failing their members. They've been offered relatively good offers to increase, which is still beneath barely a war.
Yeah, I think pilots will be negatively impacted. Though, yeah.
So off they go. There's another one. So that's two in the last 2 weeks. So
they're escalating.
Yeah. What it is showing is the unions are stepping away now because they realise the risk that used to exist of getting nothing or less than nothing has gone. So
it's not worth fighting. Yeah.
All right. Let's go into labour hire. Am I on to labour hire?
Yes.
Jumped a topic.
The first application for a labour hire order.
Yeah. So a labour hire order is where an employee hits site and has been there for a period of 3 months, or if there's some anti-avoidance behaviour like removing the 2 months and 29 days type thing, Fair Work Commission can make an order that the labour hire employees are paid the same as site-based employees on an EA.
The order just asks for the EA to also cover the labour hire workers.
So here in this case...
it's gone to the wrong case.
It's okay. No, it's me. I've jumped ahead. So we'll talk about my case that I just talked about in a few seconds. We'll come back. That was pretty dumb, wasn't it? I just looked at labour hire.
No, I think we skipped to Qantas and that went above. This is the next labour. But basically that was the summary.
Yeah, that's the summary. We'll jump
this is the actual labour hire case.
Okay, so in this case, this is a slightly different case. This is a case of a woman who was placed at Amazon. There was an expectation after 3 months to become a permanent employee of Amazon. That wasn't realised. Amazon made a decision not to do that, probably based on innuendo.
She made aggressive behaviour and stared in an intimidating manner.
And probably was objectively not reasonable. Adecco removed her from the site.
After investigation.
After the investigation. And then...
Didn't give her another job. Said that she could seek other jobs from Adecco, but
they would have to be honest about behaviour.
About feedback, but she wasn't terminated because she was still on their books, is what they said.
Yeah, and the court laughed at that and said no.
She filed a general protections claim.
Yeah, and basically the court said, look, don't try and pretend that she could get work and she's employed. She's clearly not. But for Nina and I, this case was interesting because this is a classic problem with labour hire. When a host... You know, we draft labour hire agreements to prevent hosts from doing this type of behaviour where there has to be a reasonable basis. Here she wasn't even informed thoroughly of the truth of what occurred. So there's a whole lot of problems.
Yeah, she didn't know what was substantiated.
Yeah. But the problem is if a labour hire business has an employee return to them, particularly in regional Australia, the likelihood of them finding out further employment is almost zero.
Hmm.
So, and that's the reason labour hire almost always use casual employees to get around that particular issue. But obviously where there is a protracted period of labour hire employee having reasonable expectation of continuing work, that alters and you end up with things like general protection claims and termination. So, look, can you just be careful around this issue? If you're a host and someone's not performing, go down the performance path quickly and document it. Then it's not a problem for you. And it's also not a problem for the labour hire provider, and it's not a problem in workers' compensation. And the issue really for both of you in all workers' comp related stuff is often there is a set-off or indemnity clause that the host has to give to the labour hire provider. So we're just showing you what a complex set of facts can be. Let's go to the next case and try and get this one right.
It's not my fault.
No, it was my fault. It was my fault. We're in a different place. I don't know what's happening today.
It's because we skipped to Qantas, so we skipped that first labour hire. But we did summarise it. That was literally the fact.
That was the fact. Okay, yeah. Good. Okay, well, so now that we're back in gear, we're back on bounce. This was a case where a kid was climbing a climbing wall. Bounce had about 15 different kids' playground type things with trampolines, walls to climb.
Yeah.
Kid pushed himself off the top of the wall, thinking he was connected by a cable.
That he would go down slowly
and instead fell to the ground and got injured.
Oh, awful.
But there's only one reason we have this case. This is not a case that has any published decision, but we did Wakakiri last week or the week before, and we talked about inherently dangerous environments. And what the court, the magistrate's court, found in this case is exactly the decision in Wakakiri, but in a much smaller way, in that you've got kids climbing up a wall. If they're under 12, they shouldn't even be allowed in there without a parent. There is a process for making them safe. They should be trained and proved to be safe in that, because this is an inherently dangerous place and normal methods of supervision don't work.
Yeah, because it's children.
Yeah, so, but I think that's we talked about this Outward Bound. We did the Japanese tourist last week.
Yeah.
My point about inherently dangerous sites is the courts keep saying out loud, supervision can't save someone in an inherently dangerous environment. There must be better controls than that. And I want people to take that back to their workplaces and go, you know, I'm a school, we do Outward Bound. Is supervision enough? Well, they said here, there is a ratio which provides a higher level of safety, 1 to 15. You didn't have it. That was one of the issues. But always in inherently dangerous, they say, no, look, what is the evidence of risk and what is the proper controls that should be introduced to manage?
Because you can't possibly be watching them at all times.
No, you can't. So, look, I'm going to keep pushing probably for the next few months about inherently dangerous sites. It is the place where you will be prosecuted. If there's a death, it's the likelihood now throughout Australia. Inherently dangerous without appropriate controls is really throwing into the reckless endangerment space. So it's likely big things are going to happen when you get there.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the next case. I'll watch the screen.
Prosecutor.
Okay, Prosecutor is a case. There's two parts to this case. There is one which is limited to the national legislation and there is one about identification. So in Prosecutor, the argument was that a person has suffered a knee injury. There was an aggravation of a past injury, which is what is the requirement under the national legislation or the Commonwealth legislation.
An injury is defined as just physical injury.
Whereas in every other jurisdiction, it includes disease.
Yeah.
Okay. The doctor who said that it was an aggravation didn't identify the nature of the injury or disease other than to comment that he did have arthritis and had hurt his knee 5 or 6 years earlier by stepping off and jarring it, but failed to identify what the aggravation was of. So this case is about two things. One, Commonwealth jurisdiction, unquestionably, the fact that someone has osteoarthritis is not an injury, it is a disease, therefore it can't be an aggravation under the Commonwealth legislation. In Victoria, it would be an aggravation. Mm-hmm. But what we see with aggravations commonly is GPs and unfortunately IMEs fail to actually spend time identifying what the aggravation is of. And if they don't identify what it is aggravated from, it is not compensable.
Yeah, so when you say that, you mean it's not sufficient to just name the body part. It's got to be like what muscles and things within it.
And what is it a disease process? Was it arthritis that was aggravated? Mm. Was it a lateral tear to the meniscus? What was?
So you need specifics.
Yeah. And I think that Kim and I regularly see aggravation claims coming through without appropriate supporting medical evidence. At that stage, you should be rejecting the claim. So simple case. Commonwealth and state difference, but that specificity around disease injury is something that's often missing in the medical evidence. Goody good. Well, boy, we've gone through because we just ignore cases this way. We're pretty light. Okay, we've got the next one. So why are we talking about asbestos spills in New South Wales? Well, I'll tell you why. In safety legislation, we have lead jurisdictions that introduce something and the other jurisdictions follow. When we look at serious risks of asbestos under EPA legislation, New South Wales has doubled its fine to 10 million. And that doesn't sound alarming, except that Victoria is presently at 500,000, South Australia at $250,000.
Queensland's a million.
Yeah. So we're seeing, what we're seeing is this disparity issue that sits around all forms of safety law, but gradually they, except for Tasmania, they come together. And though Tasmania, the Labor government has suggested they're going to introduce industrial manslaughter. They've got no chance of winning, but they're saying. Anyway, so my point here is really that in places like Victoria, in places like New South Wales and most capital cities around Australia, any building of any commercial premises prior to 1970 involved asbestos, and it involved friable asbestos, dangerous asbestos. That means any person, any business who's doing any renovative work or knocking down and rebuilding works must be aware of this asbestos risk, and it's now not a small risk. In Victoria, the regulator who'd most likely bring the claim is actually the safety regulator, and that's because in most jurisdictions the EPA is relatively under-resourced and, to be candid with you, relatively under-skilled, but in all jurisdictions incredibly belligerent.
Yeah.
So once they do get hold of something, it's slow-moving, painful and very expensive, but that's more legal cost and money at risk cost. So it might be, if you're developing a site, it is what is the holding cost on interest and stuff. Whereas the safety regulator has much more punchy ways of doing it with much higher fines. If we start seeing, and we will now see, growth in EPAs throughout Australia around asbestos, that's something you should really be concerned with, because then not only will it be an expensive fine, but you'll have this protracted and lengthy process that you go through with the EPA.
Whereas, they really don't give up.
No, they don't. And the other part is that WorkSafe, a better resource, do have hygienists on board and are inclined to be very practical around asbestos. EPA are not inclined to be that practical. So, look, just telling you because it's something that's happening in the next 3 or 4 years, we're going to see more of it. If you're thinking of doing a renovation in 3 or 4 years on your factory or something, and it's a pre-1970s factory, be really careful. Okay. Now, this, can I say to you, sky's not falling. We've had closing the loop. We've had secure jobs. And I keep saying to you, these are not great big monstrous changes. If this case gets through the High Court and they adopt the reasoning of the plaintiff, it will be a massive change. So let's step back and say, what is this? It's called Alicia's case in Vision Australia. This is a case where a person was sacked. It was shameful, the method by which the investigative and termination process, the first judge at first instance, was appalled by it.
Yeah, because it wasn't based on any facts.
Yeah. So it's a breach of contract in employment terms. The common law of breach of contract is this. To be a breach of contract to entitle you to damages, you have to not pay notices required, not fulfil a fixed term contract, which is, remember, not an easy process to determine what is and what is not a fixed term contract, or wrongfully alleged repudiation accepted when the conduct was not repudiated, or your own repudiatory contract leading to it. And that gives rise to damages with what are called, what's been traditionally called, a limited damages claim in contract only in employment law. And this is the anomaly the High Court is dealing with, which is the only entitlement to damages for employment law breaches, the proper notice period, actual or implied, the payout of the fixed term, and if there is some procedural thing required to do before termination, the addition of that time onto the notice period.
So it's very clearly in current case law limited to those
things. It's not for injured feelings. It's not for psychological damage. It's none of those things. So the High Court over the last 5 years is quite different. They're black letter lawyers. We've seen them on every occasion they can take hold of any part of established law and realign it across the field of that law. A hunger to do it. We saw it in casuals. We saw it in contractors.
Definition of employees.
Yeah, we saw it in all those things. I think, seeing as only about 5% of cases get special leave, that's the High Court saying, we will entertain argument on it. This is a plaintiff law firm that deals with damages, not traditionally with employment matters, okay? So that should send alarm bells to you right away. But if they adopt this and say, no, you can get psychological damage from employment law, which fits with a whole lot of other cases in other types of contractual breach, then the world changes for us very dramatically. So particularly for people who are common law employees, and they're expensive people, they're people who are above the high income threshold, not caught by an award or EA, those people might not have once brought a contractual breach because it's such an expensive process, But knowing now that they can go to a common law, a Shine, a Arnold Beckett, one of those type of firms, mm-hmm. they can go, no win, no fee. They can run it. We'll see a lot more claims being run. But equally, if we look at a more unionised labour force and professional services place, there'll be a lot where, you know, professional services yeah. being award-free. We'll start to see claims being run for damages, not unfair dismissal. Now, there's a case called Russell and the Archdiocese of Sydney, which says you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't get a remedy.
But now you will be able to.
Yeah, you can't get your remedy in unfair dismissal land and then go and seek damages. Hmm. Russell was knocked over in a high court case slightly unrelated, which was a CBA case about 2 years after that. But what I think we'll end up seeing is a jurisdiction that says, look, if you go and get a remedy in unfair dismissal land, bad luck for common law. Well, so people won't do that. What they'll do is they'll hit you with a letter of demand saying they're going to bring a damages claim. Now, at that stage, you're going to try and solve it, but the difference is it's not 6 months.
Yeah, it's not going to be capped.
Yeah, so different. And so I think we'll start seeing, if it goes through, an emergence of a new style of plaintiff lawyer taking on these claims, which means many, many more claims, often really dodgy claims, but being hit with letters of demand, but having significant risk for those who are insured in that place. It's mandatory notification, it's premium risk, but there is a simple way through, isn't there? And the simple way through is do objectively fair, procedurally fair investigations.
Yeah, because what you said is it's not automatic. It's not like workers' comp where it's going to be the perception of the employee that they think it's hurt them.
Yeah.
There has to be a breach, right?
Yeah.
They have to meet that threshold before they could claim for damages.
Yeah. So, look, I think the important part of this for us is do the process right. There's no doubt there's procedural fairness required in the Fair Work Act when you're doing discipline termination. That's not a requirement of the common law at all. What this case effectively do will be implant that procedural fairness view into common law employment as well. So the answer is just do it right and document it. And, yes, claims will come, but you'll be in a defensible position. You'll be able to say to your insurer, if you're insured, here's our documentation. We're not going to pay anything. The insurer will go, yeah, don't. The world goes back to normal, but it just means doing things well. So I think of all the changes that we've talked about in the last year, if this case comes through, this is genuine change and this is not employer-friendly change. Let's hope the High Court goes, knocks out the door. Okay, let's go to our case study. I'm sure it's case study now.
Yes.
Look at that. Okay, over to you.
Darren was a senior accounts manager at Transparent Pain. Should be T-Pain instead of TV, a windows and shower screens manufacturer, wholesaler and retailer. Darren's territory was the Melbourne CBD and he had clients like Mirvac. His boss, Edwina, was under pressure. Darren had an incentive deal of selling windows and shower screens involving to large developers. As a result, he cut his cost to minimum cost to win work within incentive rules, but his measurement work was poor, requiring significant rework. He relied too heavily on his contractor installers because of the volume of work he sold. TB was losing money on his sales because of waste and rework and paying him more under his incentive program. Edwina spoke to Darren on 12th of January 2024 and explained the problem. He was on $225,000 base and the upside on incentives was an extra $300,000 in the last 9 months. Edwina said to Darren that everyone knows he's co-developers and is showing his lax work practices. Darren explained he must be close to get the work and he was just doing what they incentivized him to do. Edwina cracked it and called him a cynical. Darren was deeply hurt. He explained at any time he was working on hundreds of installations and had no support but the contractors. It was them she should be telling off. He was doing what they asked. Afterwards, every morning, Edwina sent him a message reminding him about accuracy. He was now working 14 hours a day and still reliant on contractors. He tried to work out who was trustworthy, not an easy job. 2 days before his next incentive payment was due to be calculated, Edwina and her boss Marion called him into a meeting and showed him 8 errors in measurements requiring rework. Edwina handed him a letter saying he had repudiated his contract and that they accepted it. His employment was summarily terminated. Marion said an odd quip as he walked out the room. She muttered so much for clipping both sides of the ticket. In the days that followed, Darren collapsed into a distressed mental state. He suffered significant depression. When he applied for work at another business, he was told that his past employer had told them he was taking cash from developers, and he commenced a common law damages claim and in discovery found a note from Edwina to Marion saying the word on the street was Darren was taking bribes from their major clients. Marin wrote back saying he has to go, and 2 days later he was sacked. No investigation was undertaken. The clients were never asked. Darren is beyond the classifications of the award, and there was no EA.
All right. Did Darren have a good defamation claim?
Look, I think he did, but the likelihood that the potential employer was going to give him the evidence is very unlikely.
Yeah. Look, I reckon it's not a bad defamation claim. I reckon it'd shake the tree, because what you've got to show in a defamation is that something was said that was untrue.
It was published, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was caused loss.
Published.
But he's got to have evidence. Like, I don't think they are going to stand up and do it for him.
Oh, no. Look, I'd run it. I reckon it's worth it. With the changes to the new discrimination law code that goes across Australia, he'd have to show loss. He can certainly show his loss.
Yes.
So he's got.
But the private note between the two, that wouldn't be captured.
No, that's caught on what's called a harm and undertaking. You're not allowed to utilise something in one proceeding for the benefit of another one. But it wouldn't matter, because you'd issue proceedings and seek discovery and defamation, and you'd bring it out.
But isn't that a private note? It's not published.
No. So that would in itself not be defamatory, but yeah. In discovery it would pull out as to a state of mind.
Yeah, and intention.
And lead them to an inquiry. So when we look at this, you know, the thing that makes defamation claims expensive is malice. That is.
Oh, yeah, there's definite malice.
There's definite malice there. So this is a claim that if it got up is sort of a couple $100,000 claim. But the running of the cost of it, as you've seen from the ones that the Channel 9 cases, these are expensive proceedings. Mm-hmm. There are people who take no win, no fee on defamation work. You wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of this. You'd probably settle for about $40,000 or $50,000 very, very quickly after you got the concerns notice.
Yep.
Did Edwina, Marion and Transparent Pain commit a safety wrong? And if so, what and who?
Yeah, there's heaps of psychological hazards.
Look, the repeated messaging, the wrongfulness, the
lack
pressure they put on him. Yep. All those things are clear psychological hazards. And
they yelled at him and swore at him.
Yeah. So I reckon they're all in the go. There's nothing there that's reckless endangerment. There's clear breach of primary duties.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if they were officers as well.
Yeah. Well, I think Marion, if we elevate Marion to an officer under Section 14, she does have a state of knowledge in Victoria. Yeah. Objectively, in every other state and territory, she ought to have the knowledge. And she did participate, so she has actual knowledge, so it triggers the Section 27 due diligence obligation, so she's gone. 3, has Darren got a good common law damages claim? What would be the impact of the new Alicia's case if approved by the High Court?
Well, so, there's a breach because he didn't repudiate.
So, yes, so there is a common law claim in respect of it's a wrongful repudiation, okay? So he'd be entitled to his notice, and if he didn't have specific notice, given his seniority and the nature of his job, he'd probably be entitled to 6 to 9 months' notice, okay?
Oh.
So let's remember, if you don't put a notice provision in your agreement.
Who doesn't have a notice provision in their agreement?
We got one through the other day where there's no notice provision.
Oh, my God.
You're back to common law notice, okay? Alicia's case changes it dramatically because you do have actual causative evidence, so direct causation of the wrongfulness and the psychological damage that was suffered.
Mm.
And then you've got the sequelae of their misbehaviour that led to further unemployment. So his obligation when breached is to mitigate his loss. He's prevented from mitigating his loss as a result of their conduct.
Yeah.
Therefore, his claim is in the millions. It's a stinker claim under Alicia's case, which is why we talked about it, just to show you how something that went from a $100,000 claim to north of $1 million just because of one case presently
crazy.
In the High Court. So it's not the law at the moment. I want to be absolutely clear about that. But it could become the law, and if it was ever going to be, this is the High Court that will turn the corner on it. Okay?
You'll finally have your Chicken Little moment.
I'll have my Chicken Little. The sky is falling. All right.
I think one last question.
One last question. Would Darren have a good workers' comp claim, and what would be the impact on premium? Let's just use Victoria as an example. Yes, the behaviour before. Yes, the termination process, there is case law and workers' comp that the wrongfulness of the termination process can give rise to a workers' comp claim.
Yeah.
So yes and yes. And yes, because he's now out the door and he's unemployable, he maxes out premium on it.
It's a substantial case.
So if you look at a 42% increase in base, plus on top of that a maximum cap gone from 30% to 75%, if this is a big business, you're probably talking about $1.5 million risk in premium. Massive risk.
Yeah.
Okay. Huge. So really good. I think that's it, Nana.
Thanks, everyone.
I'm sorry we mucked up that case. It was terrible, wasn't it?
Keep
watching. Just remember, we've filled our workers' comp group, but keep sending in to admin and we'll do another one and we'll stick you in there.
Okay.
All right. See you later. Cheers. Thumbs up, guys. Bye-bye.